She wants to hire you. She wants you to start on Monday. She said she wanted you from the beginning, but Laura talked her into hiring the other person. So, Ifem, you have a job. Cash! Under the table. Ifem's go! This is great. She'll pay you $250 a week, more than the old babysitter, and pure cash under the table. Kimberly is a really great person. I'm coming tomorrow to take you over there to see her.
Ifemelu said nothing, struggling to understand. Words took so long to form meaning. The next day, Ginnika knocked and knocked on her door before Ifemelu finally opened and saw Allison standing on the landing at the back, watching curiously.
"We're late already. Get dressed,"
Ginnika said, firmly, authoritatively, with no room for dissent. Ifemelu pulled on a pair of jeans. She felt Ginnika watching her. In the car, Ginnika's rock music filled the silence between them. They were on Lancaster Avenue, just about to cross over from West Philadelphia, with boarded-up buildings and hamburger wrappers strewn around, and into the spotless, tree-filled suburbs of the main line, when Ginnika said, "I think you're suffering from depression." Ifemelu shook her head and turned to the window. Depression was what happened to Americans, with their self-absolving need to turn everything into an illness. She was not suffering from depression. She was merely a little tired and a little slow.
"I don't have depression," she said. Years later, she would blog about this.
"On the subject of non-American blacks suffering from illnesses whose names they refuse to know." A Congolese woman wrote a long comment in response. She had moved to Virginia from Kinshasa, and months into her first semester of college, begun to feel dizzy in the morning, her heart pounding as though in flight from her, her stomach fraught with nausea, her fingers tingling. She went to see a doctor, and even though she checked yes to all the symptoms on the card the doctor gave her, she refused to accept the diagnosis of panic attacks, because panic attacks happened only to Americans. Nobody in Kinshasa had panic attacks. It was not even that it was called by another name. It was simply not called at all. Did things begin to exist only when they were named?
"Ifem, this is something a lot of people go through, and I know it's not been easy for you adjusting to a new place and still not having a job. We don't talk about things like depression in Nigeria, but it's real. You should see somebody at the health center. There's always therapists."
Ifemelu kept her face to the window. She felt again that crushing desire to cry, and she took a deep breath, hoping it would pass. She wished she had told Ginnika about the tennis coach, taking the train to Ginnika's apartment on that day. But now it was too late. Her self-loathing had hardened inside her. She would never be able to form the sentences to tell her story.
"Ginnika," she said. "Thank you."
Her voice was hoarse. The tears had come. She could not control them. Ginnika stopped at a gas station, gave her a tissue, and waited for her sobs to die down before she started the car and drove to Kimberly's house.
Chapter 16. Kimberly called it a signing bonus.
"Ginnika told me you've had some challenges,"
Kimberly said.
"Please, don't refuse."
It would not have occurred to Ifemelu to refuse the check. Now she could pay some bills, send something home to her parents. Her mother liked the shoes she sent, tasseled and tapering, the kind she could wear to church.
"Thank you,"
her mother said, and then sighing heavily over the phone line, she added,
"Obinze came to see me."
Ifemelu was silent.
"Whatever problem you have, please discuss it with him,"
her mother said. Ifemelu said, "Okay," and began to talk about something else. When her mother said there had been no light for 2 weeks, it seemed suddenly foreign to her, and home itself a distant place. She could no longer remember what it felt like to spend an evening in candlelight. She no longer read the news on Nigeria.com, because each headline, even the most unlikely ones, somehow reminded her of Obinze. At first she gave herself a month to let her self-loathing seep away, then she would call Obinze. But a month passed, and still she kept Obinze sealed in silence, gagged her own mind so that she would think of him as little as possible. She still deleted his emails unread. Many times she started to write to him. She crafted emails and then stopped and discarded them. She would have to tell him what happened, and she could not bear the thought of telling him what happened. She felt shamed. She had failed. Ginnika kept asking what was wrong, why she had shut out Obinze, and she said it was nothing, she just wanted some space, and Ginnika gaped at her in disbelief. You just want some space? Early in the spring, a letter arrived from Obinze. Deleting his emails took a click, and after the first click, the others were easier because she could not imagine reading the second if she had not read the first. But a letter was different. It brought to her the greatest sorrow she had ever felt. She sank to her bed, holding the envelope in her hand. She smelled it, stared at his familiar handwriting. She imagined him at his desk in his boys' quarters, near his small humming refrigerator, writing in that calm manner of his. She wanted to read the letter, but she could not get herself to open it. She put it on her table. She would read it in a week. She needed a week to gather her strength. She would reply too, she told herself. She would tell him everything. But a week later, the letter still lay there. She placed a book on top of it, then another book, and one day it was swallowed beneath files and books. She would never read it. Taylor was easy, a childish child, the playful one who was sometimes so naive that Ifemelu guiltily thought him stupid. But Morgan, only 3 years older, already wore the mourning demeanor of a teenager. She read many grades above her level, was steeped in enrichment classes, and watched adults with a hooded gaze, as though privy to the darkness that lurked in their lives. At first, Ifemelu disliked Morgan, responding to what she thought was Morgan's own disturbingly full-grown dislike. She was cool, sometimes even cold, to Morgan during her first weeks with them, determined not to indulge this spoilt, silken child with a dusting of burgundy freckles on her nose. But she had come with the passing months to care for Morgan, an emotion she was careful not to show to Morgan. Instead, she was firm and neutral, staring back when Morgan stared. Perhaps it was why Morgan did what Ifemelu asked. She would do it coldly, indifferently, grudgingly, but she would do it. She routinely ignored her mother, and with her father, her brooding watchfulness sharpened into poison. Don would come home and sweep into the den, expecting that everything would stop because of him. And everything did stop, except for whatever Morgan was doing. Kimberly, fluttery and ardent, would ask how his day was, scrambling to please, as though she could not quite believe that he had again come home to her. Taylor would hurl himself into Don's arms, and Morgan would look up from the TV, or a book or a game, to watch him, as though she saw through him, while Don pretended not to squirm under her piercing eyes. Sometimes Ifemelu wondered, was it Don? Was he cheating? And had Morgan found out? Cheating was the first thing anyone would think of with a man like Don, with that lubricious aura of his. But he might be satisfied with suggestiveness alone. He would flirt outrageously, but not do more, because an affair would require some effort, and he was the kind of man who took, but did not give. Ifemelu thought often of that afternoon early in her babysitting. Kimberly was out, Taylor was playing, and Morgan reading in the den. Suddenly, Morgan put down her book, calmly walked upstairs, and ripped off the wallpaper in her room, pushed down her dresser, yanked off her bed covers, tore down the curtains, and was on her knees, pulling and pulling and pulling at the strongly glued carpet, when Ifemelu ran in and stopped her. Morgan was like a small steel robot, writhing to be let free, with a strength that frightened Ifemelu. Perhaps the child would end up being a serial murderer, like those women on television crime documentaries, standing half-naked on dark roads to lure truck drivers, and then strangle them. When finally Ifemelu let go, slowly loosening her grip on a quietened Morgan, Morgan went back downstairs to her book. Later, Kimberly in tears asked her, "Honey, please tell me what's wrong." And Morgan said, "I'm too old for all that pink stuff in my room." Now Kimberly took Morgan twice a week to a therapist in Bala Cynwyd. Both she and Don were more tentative towards her, more cowering under her denouncing stare. When Morgan won an essay contest at school, Don came home with a present for her. Kimberly anxiously stood at the bottom of the stairs while Don went up to present the gift, wrapped in sparkly paper. He came down moments later.
She wouldn't even look at it. She just got up and went into the bathroom and stayed there. He said, I left it on the bed.
It's okay, honey. She'll come around,
Kimberly said, hugging him, rubbing his back. Later, Kimberly sotto voce told Ifemelu.
Morgan's really hard on him. He tries so hard and she won't let him in. She just won't.
Morgan doesn't let anyone in, Ifemelu said. Don needed to remember that Morgan and not he was the child.
She listens to you,
Kimberly said, a little sadly. Ifemelu wanted to say, I don't give her too many choices, because she wished Kimberly would not be so sheer in her yieldingness. Perhaps Morgan just needed to feel that her mother could push back. Instead, she said,
That's because I'm not her family. She doesn't love me, and so she doesn't feel all these complicated things for me. I'm just a nuisance at best.
I don't know what I'm doing wrong, Kimberly said.
It's a phase. It'll pass. You'll see.
She felt protective of Kimberly. She wanted to shield Kimberly.
The only person she really cares about is my cousin Kurt. She adores him. If we have family gatherings, she'll brood unless Kurt is there. I'll see if he can come visit and talk to her.
Laura had brought a magazine.
Look at this, Ifemelu, she said. It isn't Nigeria, but it's close. I know celebrities can be flighty, but she seems to be doing good work.
Ifemelu and Kimberly looked at the page together. A thin white woman, smiling at the camera, holding a dark-skinned African baby in her arms. And all around her, little dark-skinned African children were spread out like a rug. Kimberly made a sound, a
hmm?
As though she was unsure how to feel.
She's stunning, too, Laura said.
Yes, she is, Ifemelu said. And she's just as skinny as the kids, only that her skinniness is by choice, and theirs is not by choice.
A pop of loud laughter burst out from Laura.
You are funny. I love how sassy you are.
Kimberly did not laugh. Later, alone with Ifemelu, she said,
I'm sorry Laura said that. I've never liked that word, sassy. It's the kind of word that's used for certain people and not for others.
Ifemelu shrugged and smiled and changed the subject. She did not understand why Laura looked up so much information about Nigeria, asking her about 419 scams, telling her how much money Nigerians in America sent back home every year. It was an aggressive, unaffectionate interest. Strange indeed to pay so much attention to something you did not like. Perhaps it was really about Kimberly, and Laura was, in some distorted way, aiming at her sister by saying things that would make Kimberly launch into apologies. It seemed too much work for too little gain, though. At first, Ifemelu thought Kimberly's apologizing sweet, even if unnecessary, but she had begun to feel a flash of impatience, because Kimberly's repeated apologies were tinged with self-indulgence, as though she believed that she could, with apologies, smooth all the scalloped surfaces of the world. A few months into her babysitting, Kimberly asked her,
Would you consider living in? The basement is really a one-bedroom apartment with a private entrance. It would be rent-free, of course.
Ifemelu was already looking for a studio apartment, eager to leave her roommates now that she could afford to, and she did not want to be further enmeshed in the lives of the Turners. Yet she considered saying yes, because she heard a plea in Kimberly's voice. In the end, she decided she could not live with them. When she said no, Kimberly offered her the use of their spare car.
It'll make it much easier for you to get here after your classes. It's an old thing. We were going to give it away. I hope it doesn't stop you on the road, she said,
as if the Honda, only a few years old, its body unmarked, could possibly stop on the road.
You really shouldn't trust me to take your car home. What if I don't come back one day?
Ifemelu said. Kimberly laughed.
It's not worth very much.
You do have an American license? Laura asked. I mean, you can drive legally in this country.
Of course she can, Laura, Kimberly said. Why would she accept the car if she couldn't?
I'm just checking, Laura said, as though Kimberly could not be depended upon to ask the necessary tough questions of non-American citizens. Ifemelu watched them, so alike in their looks, and both unhappy people. But Kimberly's unhappiness was inward, unacknowledged, shielded by her desire for things to be as they should, and also by hope. She believed in other people's happiness because it meant that she too might one day have it. Laura's unhappiness was different, spiky. She wished that everyone around her were unhappy because she had convinced herself that she would always be.
Yes, I have an American license, Ifemelu said,
and then she began to talk about the safe driving course she had taken in Brooklyn before she got her license, and how the instructor, a thin white man with matted hair the color of straw, had cheated. In the dark basement room full of foreigners, the entrance of which was an even darker flight of narrow stairs, the instructor had collected all the cash payments before he showed the safe driving film on the wall projector. From time to time he made jokes that nobody understood and chuckled to himself. Ifemelu was a little suspicious of the film. How could a car driving so slowly have caused that amount of damage in an accident, leaving the driver's neck broken? Afterwards, he gave out the test questions. Ifemelu found them easy, quickly shading in the answers in pencil. A small South Asian man beside her, perhaps 50 years old, kept glancing over at her, his eyes pleading, while she pretended not to understand that he wanted her help. The instructor collected the papers, brought out a clay-colored eraser, and began to wipe out some of the answers and to shade in others. Everybody passed. Many of them shook his hand, said, "Thank you, thank you," in a wide range of accents before they shuffled out. Now they could apply for American driver's licenses. Ifemelu told the story with a false openness, as though it was merely a curiosity for her, and not something she had chosen to goad Laura.
It was a strange moment for me, because until then I thought nobody in America cheated, Ifemelu said. Kimberly said, "Oh my goodness."
"This happened in Brooklyn?" Laura asked.
"Yes."
Laura shrugged, as though to say that it would, of course, happen in Brooklyn, but not in the America in which she lived. At issue was an orange, a round, flame-colored orange that Ifemelu had brought with her lunch, peeled and quartered, and enclosed in a Ziploc bag. She ate it at the kitchen table, while Taylor sat nearby, writing in his homework sheet.
"Would you like some, Taylor?" she asked, and offered him a piece.
"Thanks," he said.
He put it into his mouth. His face crumpled.
"It's bad. It's got stuff in it."
"Those are the seeds," she said, looking at what he had spat into his hand.
"The seeds?"
"Yes, the orange seeds."
"Oranges don't have stuff in them."
"Yes, they do. Throw that in the trash, Taylor. I'm going to put the learning video in for you."
"Oranges don't have stuff in them," he repeated.
All his life, he had eaten oranges without seeds. Oranges grown to look perfectly orange and to have faultless skin and no seeds. So at 8 years old he did not know that there was such a thing as an orange with seeds. He ran into the den to tell Morgan about it. She looked up from her book, raised a slow, bored hand, and tucked her red hair behind her ear.
"Of course oranges have seeds. Mom just buys the seedless variety. Ifemelu didn't get the right kind."
She gave Ifemelu one of her accusatory glares.
"The orange is the right one for me, Morgan. I grew up eating oranges with seeds," Ifemelu said, turning on the video.
"Okay," Morgan shrugged. With Kimberly, she would have said nothing, only glowered. The doorbell rang. It had to be the carpet cleaner. Kimberly and Don were hosting a cocktail party fundraiser the next day for a friend of theirs about whom Don had said,
"It's just an ego trip for him running for Congress. He won't even come close."
And Ifemelu was surprised that he seemed to recognize the ego of others while blinded in the fog of his own. She went to the door. A burly red-faced man stood there, carrying cleaning equipment, something slung over his shoulder, something else that looked like a lawnmower propped at his feet. He stiffened when he saw her. First surprise flitted over his features, then it ossified to hostility. "You need a carpet cleaned?" he asked, as if he did not care, as if she could change her mind, as if he wanted her to change her mind. She looked at him, a taunt in her eyes, prolonging a moment loaded with assumptions. He thought she was a homeowner, and she was not what he had expected to see in this grand stone house with the white pillars. "Yes," she said finally, suddenly tired. "Mrs. Tanner told me you were coming." It was like a conjurer's trick, the swift disappearance of his hostility. His face sank into a grin. She, too, was the help. The universe was once again arranged as it should be.
"How are you doing? Know where she wants me to start?"
he asked. "Upstairs," she said, letting him in, wondering how all that cheeriness could have existed earlier in his body. She would never forget him. Bits of dried skin stuck to his chapped, peeling lips, and she would begin the blog post, sometimes in America, races class, with a story of his dramatic change, and end with, "It didn't matter to him how much money I had. As far as he was concerned, I did not fit as the owner of that stately house because of the way I looked." In America's public discourse, blacks, as a whole, are often lumped with poor whites. Not poor blacks and poor whites, but blacks and poor whites. A curious thing indeed. Taylor was excited.
"Can I help? Can I help?"
he asked the carpet cleaner.
"No, thanks, buddy," the man said. "I got it."
"I hope he doesn't start in my room,"
Morgan said.
"Why?"
Ifemelu asked.
"I just don't want him to."
Ifemelu wanted to tell Kimberly about the carpet cleaner, but Kimberly might become flustered and apologize for what was not her fault, as she often, too often, apologized for Laura. It was discomforting to observe how Kimberly lurched, keen to do the right thing and not knowing what the right thing was. If she told Kimberly about the carpet cleaner, there was no telling how she would respond. Laugh, apologize, snatch up the phone to call the company and complain. And so instead, she told Kimberly about Taylor and the orange.
"He really thought Seeds meant it was bad? How funny."
Morgan, of course, promptly set him right, Ifemelu said.
"Oh, she would."
"When I was a little girl, my mother used to tell me that an orange would grow on my head if I swallowed a seed. I had many anxious mornings of going to look in the mirror. At least Taylor won't have that childhood trauma." Kimberly laughed.
"Hello?"
It was Laura, coming in through the back door with Athena, a tiny wisp of a child with hair so thin that her pale scalp gaped through. A waif. Perhaps Laura's blended vegetables and strict diet rules had left the child malnourished. Laura put a vase on the table.
"This will look terrific tomorrow."
"It's lovely,"
Kimberly said, bending to kiss Athena's head.
"That's the caterer's menu? Don thinks the hors d'oeuvre selection is too simple. I'm not sure."
"He wants you to add more,"
Laura said, scanning the menu.
"He just thought it was a little simple. He was very sweet about it."
In the den, Athena began to cry. Laura went to her. And soon enough, a string of negotiations followed.
"Do you want this one, sweetheart? The yellow, or the blue, or the red? Which do you want?"
"Just give her one," Ifemelu thought. To overwhelm a child of four with choices, to lay on her the burden of making a decision, was to deprive her of the bliss of childhood. Adulthood, after all, already loomed, where she would have to make grimmer and grimmer decisions. "She's been grumpy today," Laura said, coming back into the kitchen, Athena's crying quelled. "I took her to a follow-up from the ear infection, and she's been an absolute bear all day. Oh, and I met the most charming Nigerian man today. We get there, and it turns out a new doctor has just joined the practice, and he's Nigerian, and he came by and said hello to us. He reminded me of you, Ifemelu. I read on the Internet that Nigerians are the most educated immigrant group in this country. Of course, it says nothing about the millions who live on less than a dollar a day back in your country, but when I met the doctor, I thought of that article and of you and other privileged Africans who are here in this country. Laura paused, and Ifemelu, as she often did, felt that Laura had more to say but was holding back. It felt strange to be called privileged. Privileged was people like Kayode da Silva, whose passport sagged with the weight of visa stamps, who went to London for summer and to Ikoyi Club to swim, who could casually get up and say, "We're going to French's for ice cream."
"I've never been called privileged in my life," Ifemelu said. "It feels good."
"I think I'll switch and have him be Athena's doctor. He was wonderful, so well-groomed and well-spoken. I haven't been very satisfied with Dr. Bingham since Dr. Hoffman left anyway." Laura picked up the menu again. "In graduate school, I knew a woman from Africa who was just like this doctor. I think she was from Uganda. She was wonderful. And she didn't get along with the African-American woman in our class at all. She didn't have all those issues."
"Maybe when the African-American's father was not allowed to vote because he was black, the Ugandan's father was running for parliament or studying at Oxford," Ifemelu said.
Laura stared at her, made a mocking, confused face. "Wait, did I miss something?"
"I just think it's a simplistic comparison to make. You need to understand a bit more history," Ifemelu said.
Laura's lips sagged. She staggered, collected herself.
"Well, I'll get my daughter and then go find some history books from the library, if I can figure out what they look like," Laura said, and marched out.
Ifemelu could almost hear Kimberly's heart beating wildly.
"I'm sorry," Ifemelu said. Kimberly shook her head and murmured, "I know Laura can be challenging,"
her eyes on the salad she was mixing. Ifemelu hurried upstairs to Laura.
"I'm sorry. I was rude just now, and I apologize."
But she was sorry only because of Kimberly, the way she had begun to mix the salad as though to reduce it to a pulp.
"It's fine,"
Laura sniffed, smoothing her daughter's hair, and Ifemelu knew that for a long time afterwards she would not unwrap from herself the pashmina of the wounded. Apart from a stiff "hi," Laura did not speak to her at the party the next day. The house filled with a gentle murmur of voices, guests raising wine glasses to their lips. They were similar, all of them. Their clothes nice and safe, their sense of humor nice and safe, and like other upper-middle-class Americans, they used the word "wonderful" too often.
"You'll come and help out with the party, won't you, please?" Kimberly had asked Ifemelu, as she always did of their gatherings.
Ifemelu was not sure how she helped out, since the events were catered and the children went to bed early, but she sensed beneath the lightness of Kimberly's invitation something close to a need. In some small way that she did not entirely understand, her presence seemed to steady Kimberly. If Kimberly wanted her there, then she would be there.
"This is Ifemelu, our babysitter, and my friend,"
Kimberly introduced her to guests.
"You're so beautiful,"
a man told her, smiling, his teeth jarringly white. "African women are gorgeous, especially Ethiopians." A couple spoke about their safari in Tanzania.
"We had a wonderful tour guide, and we're now paying for his first daughter's education."
Two women spoke about their donations to a wonderful charity in Malawi that built wells, a wonderful orphanage in Botswana, a wonderful microfinance cooperative in Kenya. Ifemelu gazed at them. There was a certain luxury to charity that she could not identify with and did not have. To take charity for granted, to revel in this charity towards people whom one did not know, perhaps it came from having had yesterday, and having today, and expecting to have tomorrow. She envied them this. A petite woman in a severe pink jacket said,
"I'm chair of the board of a charity in Ghana. We work with rural women. We're always interested in African staff. We don't want to be the NGO that won't use local labor. So if you're ever looking for a job after graduation and want to go back and work in Africa, give me a call."
"Thank you."
Ifemelu wanted suddenly and desperately to be from the country of people who gave, and not those who received.
to be one of those who had, and could therefore bask in the grace of having given, to be among those who could afford copious pity and empathy. She went out to the deck in search of fresh air. Over the hedge, she could see the Jamaican nanny of the neighbor's children, walking down the driveway, the one who always evaded Ifemelu's eyes and did not like to say hello. Then she noticed a movement on the other end of the deck. It was Don. There was something furtive about him, and she felt rather than saw that he had just ended a cell phone conversation.
"Great party," he told her. "It's just an excuse for Kim and me to have friends over. Roger is totally out of his league, and I've told him that. No chance in hell."
Don kept talking, his voice too larded in bonhomie, her dislike clawing at her throat. She and Don did not talk like this. It was too much information, too much talk. She wanted to tell him that she had heard nothing of his phone conversation, if there had been anything at all to hear, that she knew nothing and that she did not want to know.
"They must be wondering where you are," she said.
"Yes, we must go back,"
he said, as though they had come out together. Back inside, Ifemelu saw Kimberly standing in the middle of the den, slightly apart from her circle of friends. She had been looking around for Don, and when she saw him, her eyes rested on him, and her face became soft and shorn of worry. Ifemelu left the party early. She wanted to speak to Dike before his bedtime. Auntie Uju picked up the phone.
"Has Dike slept?"
Ifemelu asked.
"He's brushing his teeth,"
she said, and then in a lower voice she added,
"He was asking me about his name again."
"What did you tell him?"
"The same thing. You know, he never asked me this kind of thing before we moved here."
"Maybe it's having Bartholomew in the picture, and the new environment. He's used to having you to himself."
"This time, he didn't ask why he has my name. He asked if he has my name because his father did not love him."
"Auntie, maybe it's time to tell him you are not a second wife," Ifemelu said.
"I was practically a second wife."
Auntie Uju sounded defiant, even petulant, clenching her fist tightly around her own story. She had told DK that his father was in the military government, that she was his second wife, and that they had given him her surname to protect him, because some people in the government, not his father, had done some bad things.
"Okay, here's DK,"
Auntie Uju said, in a normal tone.
"Hey, cuz, you should have seen my soccer game today,"
DK said.
"How come you score all the great goals when I'm not there? Are these goals in your dreams?"
Ifemelu asked. He laughed. He still laughed easily, his sense of humor whole. But since the move to Massachusetts, he was no longer transparent. Something had filmed itself around him, making him difficult to read. His head perennially bent towards his Game Boy, looking up once in a while to view his mother and the world, with a weariness too heavy for a child. His grades were falling. Auntie Uju threatened him more often. The last time Ifemelu visited, Auntie Uju told him,
"I will send you back to Nigeria if you do that again,"
speaking Igbo, as she did to him only when she was angry. And Ifemelu worried that it would become for him the language of strife. Auntie Uju, too, had changed. At first, she had sounded curious, expectant about her new life.
"This place is so white," she said. "Do you know, I went to the drugstore to quickly buy lipstick, because the mall is 30 minutes away, and all the shades were too pale. But they can't carry what they can't sell. At least this place is quiet and restful, and I feel safe drinking the tap water, something I will never even try in Brooklyn."
Slowly, over the months, her tone soured.
"Dicky's teacher said he's aggressive," she told Ifemelu one day, after she'd been called to come in and see the principal. "Aggressive of all things. She wants him to go to what they call special ed, where they will put him in a class alone and bring somebody who is trained to deal with mental children to teach him. I told the woman, that is not my son. It is her father who is aggressive. Look at him. Just because he looks different. When he does what other little boys do, it becomes aggression. Then the principal told me, DK is just like one of us. We don't see him as different at all. What kind of pretending is that? I told him to look at my son. There are only two of them in the whole school. The other child is a half-caste, and so fair that if you look from afar, you will not even know that he is black.
My son sticks out, so how can you tell me that you don't see any difference? I refuse completely that they should put him in a special class. He is brighter than all of them combined. They want to start now to mark him. Kimmy warned me about this. She said they tried to do it to her son in Indiana.
Later, Aunt Yuju's complaints turned to her residency program. How slow and small it was. Medical records still handwritten and kept in dusty files. And then, when she finished her residency, she complained about the patients, who thought they were doing her a favor by seeing her. She hardly mentioned Bartholomew. It was as though she lived only with DK in the Massachusetts house by the lake.
Chapter 17.
If Emelu decided to stop faking an American accent, on a sunlit day in July, the same day she met Blaine, it was convincing, the accent. She had perfected from careful watching of friends and newscasters the blurring of the T, the creamy roll of the R, the sentences starting with, "So," and the sliding response of, "Oh, really?" But the accent creaked with consciousness. It was an act of will. It took an effort, the twisting of lip, the curling of tongue. If she were in a panic, or terrified, or jerked awake during a fire, she would not remember how to produce those American sounds. And so she resolved to stop, on that summer day, the weekend of DK's birthday. Her decision was prompted by a telemarketer's call. She was in her apartment on Spring Garden Street, the first that was truly hers in America, hers alone, a studio with a leaky faucet and a noisy heater. In the week since she moved in, she had felt light-footed, cloaked in well-being, because she opened the fridge knowing that everything in it was hers, and she cleaned the bathtub, knowing she would not find tufts of disconcertingly foreign roommate hair in the drain.
"Officially, two blocks away from the real hood," was how the apartment super Jamal had put it, when he told her to expect to hear gunshots from time to time.
But although she had opened her window every evening, straining and listening, all she heard were the sounds of late summer, music from passing cars, the high-spirited laughter of playing children, the shouting of their mothers. On that July morning, her weekend bag already packed for Massachusetts, she was making scrambled eggs when the phone rang. The caller ID showed unknown, and she thought it might be a call from her parents in Nigeria. But it was a telemarketer, a young male American who was offering better long-distance and international phone rates. She always hung up on telemarketers, but there was something about his voice that made her turn down the stove and hold on to the receiver. Something poignantly young, untried, untested, the slightest of tremors, an aggressive customer service friendliness that was not aggressive at all. It was as though he was saying what he had been trained to say, but was mortally worried about offending her. He asked how she was, how the weather was in her city, and told her it was pretty hot in Phoenix. Perhaps it was his first day on the job, his telephone piece poking uncomfortably in his ear, while he half hoped that the people he was calling would not be home to pick up. Because she felt strangely sorry for him, she asked whether he had rates better than 57 cents a minute to Nigeria.
"Hold on, while I look up Nigeria," he said,
and she went back to stirring her eggs. He came back and said his rates were the same, but wasn't there another country that she called? Mexico, Canada?
"Well, I call London sometimes," she said.
Ginnica was there for the summer.
"Okay, hold on while I look up France," he said.
She burst out laughing.
"Something funny over there?"
he asked. She laughed harder. She had opened her mouth to tell him bluntly that what was funny was that he was selling international telephone rates and did not know where London was. But something held her back, an image of him, perhaps 18 or 19, overweight, pink-faced, awkward around girls, keen on video games and with no knowledge of the roiling contradictions that were the world. So she said,
"There's a hilarious old comedy on TV."
"Oh, really?" he said, and he laughed too. It broke her heart, his greenness, and when he came back on to tell her the France rates, she thanked him and said they were better than the rates she already had, and that she would think about switching carriers.
"When is a good time to call you back, if that's okay?"
he said. She wondered whether they were paid on commission.
Would his paycheck be bigger if she did switch her phone company? Because she would, as long as it cost her nothing.
Evenings, she said. May I ask who I'm talking to? My name is Ifemelu.
He repeated her name with exaggerated care.
Is it a French name?
No, Nigerian.
That where your family came from?
Yes. She scooped the eggs onto a plate. I grew up there.
Oh, really? How long have you been in the U.S.?
3 years.
Wow, cool. You sound totally American.
Thank you. Only after she hung up did she begin to feel the stain of a burgeoning shame spreading all over her for thanking him, for crafting his words, "You sound American," into a garland that she hung around her own neck. Why was it a compliment, an accomplishment, to sound American? She had won. Christina Thomas, pallid-faced Christina Thomas, under whose gaze she had shrunk like a small defeated animal, would speak to her normally now. She had won, indeed, but her triumph was full of air. Her fleeting victory had left in its wake a vast, echoing space, because she had taken on for too long a pitch of voice and a way of being that was not hers. And so she finished eating her eggs and resolved to stop faking the American accent. She first spoke without the American accent that afternoon at 30th Street Station, leaning towards the woman behind the Amtrak counter. Could I have a round trip to Haver Hill, please? Returning Sunday afternoon. I have a student advantage card, she said, and felt a rush of pleasure from giving the T its full due in advantage, from not rolling her R in Haverhill. This was truly her. This was the voice with which she would speak if she were woken up from a deep sleep during an earthquake. Still, she resolved that if the Amtrak woman responded to her accent by speaking too slowly as though to an idiot, then she would put on her Mr. Abbott voice. The mannered, over-careful pronunciations she had learned during debate meetings in secondary school, when the bearded Mr. Abbott, tugging at his frayed tie, played BBC recordings on his cassette player and then made all the students pronounce words over and over until he beamed and cried, "Correct!" She would also affect, with the Mr. Abbott voice, a slight raising of her eyebrows in what she imagined was a haughty foreigner pose. But there was no need to do any of these, because the Amtrak woman spoke normally. "Can I see an ID, miss?" And so she did not use her Mr. Abbott voice until she met Blaine. The train was crowded. The seat next to Blaine was the only empty one in that car, as far as she could see, and the newspaper and bottle of juice placed on it seemed to be his. She stopped, gesturing towards the seat, but he kept his gaze levelly ahead. Behind her, a woman was pulling along a heavy suitcase, and the conductor was announcing that all personal belongings had to be moved from free seats, and Blaine saw her standing there. How could he possibly not see her? And still he did nothing. So her Mr. Abbott voice emerged. "Excuse me, are these yours? Could you possibly move them?" She placed her bag on the overhead rack and settled onto the seat, stiffly, holding her magazine, her body aligned towards the aisle and away from him. The train had begun to move when he said, "I'm really sorry, I didn't see you standing there." His apologizing surprised her, his expression so earnest and sincere that it seemed as though he had done something more offensive. "It's okay," she said, and smiled. "How are you?" he asked. She had learned to say, "Good, how are you?" in that sing-song American way, but now she said, "I'm well, thank you." "My name's Blaine," he said, and extended his hand. He looked tall, a man with skin the color of gingerbread and the kind of lean, proportioned body that was perfect for a uniform, any uniform. She knew right away that he was African-American, not Caribbean, not African, not a child of immigrants from either place. She had not always been able to tell. Once she had asked a taxi driver, "So, where are you from?" in a knowing, familiar tone, certain that he was from Ghana, and he said, "Detroit," with a shrug. But the longer she spent in America, the better she had become at distinguishing, sometimes from looks and gait, but mostly from bearing and demeanor, that fine-grained mark that culture stamps on people.
She felt confident about Blaine. He was the descendant of the black men and women who had been in America for hundreds of years.
"I'm Ife Melu.
It's nice to meet you," she said.
"Oh, are you Nigerian?"
"I am, yes."
"Bourgie Nigerian," he said, and smiled.
There was a surprising and immediate intimacy to his teasing her, calling her privileged.
"Just as bourgie as you," she said.
They were on firm flirting territory now. She looked him over quietly, his light-colored khakis and navy shirt, the kind of outfit that was selected with the right amount of thought. A man who looked at himself in the mirror, but did not look for too long. He knew about Nigerians, he told her. He was an assistant professor at Yale, and although his interest was mostly in southern Africa, how could he not know about Nigerians when they were everywhere?
"What is it? One in every five Africans is Nigerian?" he asked, still smiling.
There was something both ironic and gentle about him. It was as if he believed that they shared a series of intrinsic jokes that did not need to be verbalized.
"Yes, we Nigerians get around.
We have to. There are too many of us, and not enough space," she said. And it struck her how close to each other they were, separated only by the single armrest. He spoke the kind of American English that she had just given up, the kind that made race pollsters on the telephone assume that you were white and educated. "So is Southern Africa your discipline?" she asked.
"No, comparative politics. You can do just Africa and political science graduate programs in this country. You can compare Africa to Poland or Israel, but focusing on Africa itself, they don't let you do that."
His use of "they" suggested an "us," which would be the both of them. His nails were clean. He was not wearing a wedding band. She began to imagine a relationship, both of them waking up in the winter, cuddling in the stark whiteness of the morning light, drinking English breakfast tea. She hoped he was one of those Americans who liked tea. His juice, the bottle stuffed in the pouch in front of him, was organic pomegranate, a plain brown bottle with a plain brown label, both stylish and salutary. No chemicals in the juice, and no ink wasted on decorative labels. Where had he bought it? It was not the sort of thing that was sold at the train station. Perhaps he was vegan, and distrusted large corporations, and shopped only at farmers' markets, and brought his own organic juice from home. She had little patience for Ginnica's friends, most of whom were like that. Their righteousness made her feel both irritated and lacking. But she was prepared to forgive Blaine's pieties. He was holding a hardcover library book, whose title she could not see, and had stuffed his New York Times next to the juice bottle. When he glanced at her magazine, she wished she had brought out the Isiagba Irobi book of poems that she planned to read on the train back. He would think that she read only shallow fashion magazines. She felt the sudden and unreasonable urge to tell him how much she loved the poetry of Youssef Komunyaka to redeem herself. First she shielded with her palm the bright red lipstick on the cover model's face. Then she reached forward and pushed the magazine into the pouch in front of her, and said with a slight sniff that it was absurd how women's magazines forced images of small-boned, small-breasted white women on the rest of the multi-boned, multi-ethnic world of women to emulate.
"But I keep reading them," she said. "It's like smoking. It's bad for you, but you do it anyway."
"Multi-boned and multi-ethnic," he said, amused,
his eyes warm with unabashed interest. It charmed her that he was not the kind of man who, when he was interested in a woman, cultivated a certain cool, pretended indifference.
"Are you a grad student?" he asked.
"I'm a junior at Wilson." Did she imagine it, or did his face fall, in disappointment, in surprise?
"Really? You seem more mature."
"I am. I'd done some college in Nigeria before I left to come here." She shifted on her seat, determined to get back on firm flirting ground.
"You, on the other hand, look too young to be a professor. Your students must be confused about who the professor is."
"I think they're probably confused about a lot of stuff. This is my second year of teaching."
He paused.
"Are you thinking of graduate school?"
"Yes, but I'm worried I will leave grad school and no longer be able to speak English. I know this woman in grad school, a friend of a friend, and just listening to her talk is scary. The semiotic dialectics of intertextual modernity, which makes no sense at all.
Sometimes I feel that they live in a parallel universe of academia, speaking academese instead of English, and they don't really know what's happening in the real world.
That's a pretty strong opinion.
I don't know how to have any other kind. He laughed, and it pleased her to have made him laugh.
But I hear you,
he said.
My research interests include social movements, the political economy of dictatorships, American voting rights and representation, race and ethnicity and politics, and campaign finance. That's my classic spiel, much of which is bullshit anyway. I teach my classes, and I wonder if any of it matters to the kids.
Oh, I'm sure it does. I'd love to take one of your classes. She had spoken too eagerly. It had not come out as she wanted. She had cast herself without meaning to in the role of a potential student. He seemed keen to change the direction of the conversation. Perhaps he didn't want to be her teacher, either. He told her he was going to New Haven after visiting friends in Washington, D.C.
So, where are you headed?
He asked. Warrington. A bit of a drive from Boston. My aunt lives there.
So, do you ever come up to Connecticut?
Not much. I've never been to New Haven, but I've gone to the malls in Stamford and Clinton.
Oh, yes, malls.
His lips turned down slightly at the sides.
You don't like malls? Apart from being soulless and bland, they're perfectly fine.
She had never understood the quarrel with malls, with the notion of finding exactly the same shops in all of them. She found malls quite comforting in their sameness, and with his carefully chosen clothes, surely he had to shop somewhere.
So do you grow your own cotton and make your own clothes? She asked.
He laughed, and she laughed too. She imagined both of them, hand in hand, going to the mall in Stamford, she teasing him, reminding him of this conversation on the day they met, and raising her face to kiss him. It was not in her nature to talk to strangers on public transportation. She would do it more often when she started her blog a few years later. But she talked and talked, perhaps because of the newness of her own voice. The more they talked, the more she told herself that this was no coincidence. There was a significance to her meeting this man on the day that she returned her voice to herself. She told him with the suppressed laughter of a person impatient for the punchline of her own joke about the telemarketer who thought that London was in France. He did not laugh, but instead shook his head.
They don't train these telemarketer folks well at all. I bet he's a temp with no health insurance and no benefits.
Yes, she said, chastened. I felt kind of sorry for him.
So, my department moved buildings a few weeks ago. Yale hired professional movers and told them to make sure to put everything from each person's old office in the exact same spot in the new office. And they did. All my books were shelved in the right position. But you know what I noticed later? Many of the books had their spines upside down.
He was looking at her, as though to experience a shared revelation, and for a blank moment, she was not sure what the story was about.
Oh, the movers couldn't read, she said finally.
He nodded.
There was just something about it that totally killed me.
He let his voice trail away. She began to imagine what he would be like in bed. He would be a kind, attentive lover, for whom emotional fulfillment was just as important as ejaculation. He would not judge her slack flesh. He would wake up even-tempered every morning. She hastily looked away, afraid that he might have read her mind so startlingly clear were the images there.
"Would you like a beer?"
he asked.
"A beer?"
"Yes. The cafe car serves beers. You want one? I'm going to get one."
"Yes, thank you." She stood up, self-consciously, to let him pass, and hoped she would smell something on him. But she didn't. He did not wear cologne. Perhaps he had boycotted cologne because the makers of cologne did not treat their employees well. She watched him walk up the aisle, knowing that he knew that she was watching him. The beer offer had pleased her. She had worried that all he drank was organic pomegranate juice, but now the thought of organic pomegranate juice was pleasant, if he drank beer as well. When he came back with the beers and plastic cups, he poured hers with a flourish that, to her, was thick with romance. She had never liked beer. Growing up, it had been male alcohol, gruff and inelegant. Now, sitting next to Blaine, laughing as he told her about the first time he got truly drunk in his freshman year, she realized that she could like beer,
the grainy fullness of beer. He talked about his undergraduate years, the stupidity of eating a seaman sandwich during his fraternity initiation, constantly being called Michael Jordan in China the summer of his junior year when he travelled through Asia, his mother's death from cancer the week after he graduated. A seaman sandwich. They masturbated into a piece of pita bread, and you had to take a bite, but you didn't have to swallow.
Oh, God.
Well, hopefully you do stupid things when you're young so you don't do them when you're older, he said.
When the conductor announced that the next stop was New Haven, Ifemelu felt a stab of loss. She tore out a page from her magazine and wrote her phone number.
Do you have a card? She asked.
He touched his pockets.
I don't have any with me.
There was silence while he gathered his things, then the screeching of the train brakes. She sensed, and hoped she was wrong, that he did not want to give her his number.
Well, will you write your number then, if you remember it? She asked, a lame joke.
The beer had pushed those words out of her mouth. He wrote his number on her magazine.
You take care, he said.
He touched her shoulder lightly as he left, and there was something in his eyes, something both tender and sad, that made her tell herself that she had been wrong to sense reluctance from him. He already missed her. She moved to his seat, reveling in the warmth his body had left in its wake, and watched through the window as he walked along the platform. When she arrived at Auntie Uju's house, the first thing she wanted to do was call him. But she thought it was best to wait a few hours. After an hour, she said fuck it and called. He did not answer. She left a message. She called back later. No answer. She called and called and called. No answer. She called at midnight. She did not leave messages. The whole weekend she called and called, and he never picked up the phone. Warrington was a somnolent town, a town contented with itself, winding roads cut through thick woods. Even the main road, which the residents did not want widened for fear that it would bring in foreigners from the city, was winding and narrow. Sleepy homes were shielded by trees, and on weekends the blue lake was stippled with boats. From the dining room window of Auntie Uju's house, the lake shimmered, a blueness so tranquil that it held the gaze. Ifemelu stood by the window while Auntie Uju sat at the table drinking orange juice and airing her grievances like jewels. It had become a routine of Ifemelu's visits. Auntie Uju collected all her dissatisfactions in a silk purse, nursing them, polishing them, and then on the Saturday of Ifemelu's visit, while Bartholomew was out and DK upstairs, she would spill them out on the table and turn each one this way and that to catch the light. Sometimes she told the same story twice, how she had gone to the public library the other day, had forgotten to bring out the unreturned book from her handbag, and the guard told her, "You people never do anything right." How she walked into an examining room, and a patient asked, "Is the doctor coming?" And when she said she was the doctor, the patient's face changed to fired clay.
"Do you know, that afternoon she called to transfer her file to another doctor's office. Can you imagine?"
"What does Bartholomew think about all this?" Ifemelu gestured to take in the room, the view of the lake, the town.
"That one is too busy chasing business. He leaves early and comes home late every day. Sometimes DK doesn't even set eyes on him for a whole week."
"I'm surprised you're still here, Auntie," Ifemelu said quietly, and by here they both knew that she did not merely mean Warrington.
"I want another child. We've been trying."
Auntie Uju came and stood beside her by the window. There was the clatter of footsteps on the wooden stairs, and DK came into the kitchen, in a faded T-shirt and shorts, holding his Game Boy. Each time Ifemelu saw him, he seemed to her to have grown taller and to have become more reserved.
"Are you wearing that shirt to camp?" Auntie Uju asked him.
"Yes, ma'am," he said, his eyes on the flickering screen in his hand. Auntie Uju got up to check the oven. She had agreed this morning, his first of summer camp, to make him chicken nuggets for breakfast.
"Cuz, we still playing soccer later, right?" DK asked.
"Yes," Ifemelu said. She took a chicken nugget from his plate and put it in her mouth.
"Chicken nuggets for breakfast is strange enough, but is this chicken or just plastic?"
"Spicy plastic," he said.
She walked him to the bus and watched him get on. The pale faces of the other children at the window, the bus driver waving to her too cheerfully. She was standing there waiting when the bus brought him back that afternoon. There was a